some of us will have some questions. And before we do any other business this morning, I'd like to introduce the Reverend Lisa Lefkow from Habitat for Humanity, who is going to deliver our invocation.
Thank you to Alan and Ellie for this great privilege and opportunity to be with you this morning. As I was thinking about this opportunity to be with you today, I was challenged by our guest speaker and his great background and inspired to do a little cartooning myself. But I wanted to share with you something about what I do and where I spend my time. So apologies to Mr. Ramirez, but I did want to share with you a little bit of a story of three little low-wage earners here in Collier County who went off to find housing. And the first, a landscaper, was only able to find this small place, slightly damp and rather moldy, which he was able to rent. Our second little low-wage earner, who is a maintenance worker, had a better prospect. He was able to find this fixer-upper, and he was able to purchase it last year with a lovely subprime loan. Sad to say, at this moment, his home is now in foreclosure. So sorry about that. The third little low-wage earner, who is a clerk at Publix, applied for a home at Habitat for Humanity. And she was able to invest her 500 hours of sweat equity, put her $1,000 down payment down, and is now decorating for Christmas in her simple, decent home that she owns with an interest-free loan. So, again, apologies, Mr. Ramirez, but I want to share that with you. I didn't realize we had a screener. I would have gotten them to you in advance. Will you pray with me? Good and gracious God, in this season when the world is aware of the arrival of the Christ child, we pray for children everywhere who are living in the midst of poverty, war, oppression, famine, and fear. We ask that you would use us, gifted and capable in so many ways, to reach out and to make a difference, investing in the future of the world. Today, as we share insights and imagination, we pray that our minds might be challenged and inspired. May the thoughts of this day not be idle, but lead to action that will lay a foundation for the future. For this meal, we give thanks. Bless all those whose labor has made it possible, from farmers to field workers, chefs to servers. Bless us as we share it, that we may be strengthened in body, mind, and spirit. And all God's people said, Amen.
Wonderful. That was terrific. That was terrific.
A little more business before we eat.
I may have to hire you to do some of my cartoons.
I want to do something that we rarely do, and we should do more often, and I'm looking around to see if I'm doing... There they are. I wanted to make sure they were here. Most of you already know the staff of the Forum Club who make all of this possible, who do an incredible amount of work all year long for us to be able to enjoy this great club. Ellie Creer, the executive director, Tricia Porter, and Karen Danny, her associates, please stand and let us all thank you. And we have three other guests today I'd like to have stand. You all know that we have a scholarship program, and your contributions to this scholarship program are tax deductible thanks to the generosity and partnership of the Education Foundation of Collier County. We do not have a 501c3. They do. So when you contribute your scholarship money, it is tax deductible thanks to the Education Foundation. And here with us today are the CEO and President, Susan McManus. Susan, will you stand, please? And co-chairs Todd Bradley and Sharon Tricer. Sharon, where's Todd? Here's Todd. You'll notice that there are some scholarship forms in the middle of the table. And those of you who haven't donated yet, if you'd like to, please do. And there's also a little literature about the various programs of the Education Foundation that you may find interesting. And now, Shelley Church is going to introduce our student guests.
Good afternoon. We've got two groups of students today, so logistics is always a little bit more challenging at that point. But our first group of students, we have our homeschooled students today, and I'd like to ask the four of them to come forward, if you would. The homeschool program, it's a Christian Homes Educators Association of Collier County. It's called CHEAC. Began in 1987 with just three children. Today, there's over 130 families. Our 2009 graduating class, or their 2009 graduating class, consists of 14 seniors. The purposes of CHEAC is to provide information, support, and encouragement to local Christian homeschool families. Before I introduce the students, I'd like to acknowledge Ken Creer, who is, Ken, if you'd stand, he is sponsoring our children today, pays for their lunches for them to come. And Margaret Campbell's with us today. Margaret is one of the mothers of one of the homeschoolers who we'll be speaking to in a minute. The four homeschoolers are Rebecca Yeaman, Matthew Campbell, Nick Spano, and Adam Bultel. And I'm not going to say anything about them. I'm going to let them come forward and tell you about themselves.
All right, well, my name's Adam Bultel. I'm a senior in high school. I've been homeschooled all my life except for in second and third grade. I'm heavily involved in speech and debate. That's probably the biggest part of my homeschool experience, is that I travel around Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina and compete in debates as well as public speaking, something that I really enjoy, and I think that I found my enjoyment in that is going to lead into my future as I travel up to Wisconsin over this next year. I'll be going to a small college in Wisconsin, and I think I'll be fulfilling a job as a pastor there. I'd like to go to school to be a pastor, because I've enjoyed public speaking, and I think that I'll be able to fulfill that throughout the rest of my life. So I'm looking forward to the rest of my education over this next couple months and then leaving up to Wisconsin when that time comes.
Hi, my name is Nicholas Spano. I've been homeschooled my whole life, like Adam, and we've known each other for quite some time, and I just thank you for letting us come out here today. And my interests are more political. I would major in political science, and I'm thinking about going to UCF or possibly UF. And so that's where I find my interest at. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Yeaman, and I've been homeschooled my whole life, like these guys. And I'm dual enrolled at Edison College, and hoping to pursue a medical degree, possibly. And thank you guys for letting us all come out here, and see you later.
Hello, my name is Matthew Campbell. I'm 17. I'm a senior in high school. I've been homeschooled my entire life. My mother, bless her heart, she's got to be a saint to be able to put up with me. But my desires are to go into the United States Air Force and be a pararescue jumper. And that's where hopefully Lord's leading me to go, and that's where I'll go. Thank you.
Thank you. Great group of kids. Our second group of kids today, students, are from, when you get, this age, everybody's a kid, it seems like, Immokalee High School. I'd like to introduce Bill Ventris. Bill is sponsoring our students today, and I'd like to acknowledge Bill for his sponsorship. I think he's done this for a couple years now. Thanks, Bill. Accompanying the students today is Audrey Morris, who's Director of Guidance. Audrey, where are you? Oh, there you go. I'm sorry. all four of the students that are here today are members of National Beta Club, which is Better Education Through Achievement Club. They won the state talent and placed at national convention last summer at Myrtle Beach. There is also a student that's placed in the English competition. The Immokalee High School Beta Club is well known at the state and at the national level for their talent, their leaders, and their community service. In addition to the accomplishments in talent and academics, one of the students, Martin Lopez, is state vice president, and the club is very successful with his campaign skit. So I'd like for the Immokalee students to come up. Sergio Martinez, Martin Lopez, Gail Colas, and Jose Martinez. So I'm going to let them talk about themselves.
My name is Sergio Martinez, and I am a Mexican-American. My family is migrant, and I have been to Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Tennessee. I am involved in Beta, Executive Board, Co-op, and Mu Alpha Theta. After school, I work at Pinecrest Elementary School, where I tutor kindergarten through second grade with their homework. And through the Beta Club, I have volunteered in Relay for Life, Thanksgiving at the Park, Cemetery Cleanup, and the Feed the Families. My goal is to attend University of Florida and major in engineering.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jose Martinez, and I'm a senior at Immokalee High School. I'm also a migrant, and I've also, you know, traveled around the summer with doing field labor work. Right now, I plan to go to college. Right now, I've applied to University of Florida, University of Miami, and Duke University. My aspiration is to eventually become a doctor and get into the medical field. Still don't know what specialty, but I know I want to be a doctor. Currently, I'm number one in my class right now, and hopefully I can stay that way throughout the year. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Martin Lopez, and I'm a Mexican-American, a migrant, and I am proud to say I am a senior at Immokalee High School. I'm currently in the top 1% of my class. I'm involved in Beta, where I'm the current state vice president of Florida. I also participate in student government, executive board, restructuring board, and I've played varsity baseball for the past 3 years. I plan to attend the University of Miami, where I want to major in law and minor in business. I want to use my degree to start my own law firm in the Ave Maria area. I also want to become a politician one day and use my influence to better the nation in education, the economy, and health care. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Hi, everybody. First, I want to start off by thanking all of you for letting me be here. My name is Gail Colas, and I'm an 18-year-old senior at Immokalee High. Originally, I was born in Haiti, but I moved here since I was 6 years old, and I've been attending school at Immokalee High for the past 4 years. At Immokalee High, I'm in Beta. I'm a proud member of the Marching Band Color Guard, and I'm also the president of the Future Business Leaders of America. With the Future Business Leaders of America, I tutor kids that are struggling in academics, and as a former migrant myself, I speak three languages, English, Spanish, and Creole, and I translate for migrant families and the community. I also volunteer with Beta, and I do Thanksgiving at the Park, and I work with the elderly in Cypress Run. My goals for the future are I want to attend the University of Miami and major in international business. My goals are to hopefully travel around the world, travel to Africa and just some adversity countries and help the youth there and promote education because I know that is the key. Thank you.
As you can see, we've got some great kids with us today, and I encourage members afterwards to please come up and talk to the kids, the students, I'm sorry, I keep saying that, because we've made some great connections with other members, with students. One of the students that was here from Baron Kyer was contacted by one of the members with the president of the university that she plans to attend. So please do that. It's important to these students, and we're really delighted to have them with us today.
One more introduction, and this person is not expecting it, so she'll probably have a mouthful. But our new Vice President, Ula Norris. Ula? Now enjoy your meal, and we'll be back in a few minutes with the program. If I may have your attention, I want to introduce our guest speaker, Michael Ramirez, who is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist. After he won his first Pulitzer, he actually picketed the ceremony. It's a long story, and if he wants to tell it, I'll let him tell it. But it was very, very funny how he would, here he was in a business suit to receive the Pulitzer outside the library at Columbia University. And there were pickets because one of his cartoons had angered a certain group. And so he picked up, they didn't recognize him. He picked up a sign and joined the pickets. That'll give you some idea what a great guy he is. His mother was Japanese, father Latino, and they had an education mantra in this family that is incredible. He has four brothers and sisters. They're all doctors. He was in pre-med and then got into fine art. And so he's probably the only Pulitzer Prize winning black sheep that I know. He still does his mother's lawn in Orange County, California. And his mother brags that she's got the only Pulitzer Prize winning gardener. He doesn't do his own lawn. I've known Michael for many years. We were colleagues in the E.W. Scripps Company, and I was certainly proud after he won his first Pulitzer and brought him to the corporate office to give a talk, much like what you'll hear today. And that's when I knew when I got down here, that's when I knew I had to get him to do a repeat performance. People who worked with him in Memphis say that he had a kind of a split personality when he was preparing to do his cartoons. He was in seclusion. He did a lot of research and reading. He's probably as well-read as any journalist who's ever lived. He's extremely proud that he's never had a factual error in a cartoon. Well, maybe once. I don't know. He's only had one cartoon killed by his editor, and the editor quickly found out that was a bad idea. He's had great freedom to express his point of view. It so happens he has a new book out, which is selling very, very well, and you'll see the title of it there. I happen to know that after you hear his talk, if you want to buy one, they do have them in town at Barnes & Noble. He's won so many awards I don't even want to list them, but I do want to tell you something that Bill Bennett said about him. Quote, "When one studies Michael's cartoons, one is watching a rare combination of artful genius, intellect, and imagination moving together in harmony from mind to hand to paper, allowing others to wrestle with the same problem and questions with which he is wrestling. Studying Michael's cartoons is an intensely public and political exercise and thus a good thing for the country." So here, everyone does have a right to Michael's opinion, and today you will too. Thank you. Michael?
You know, all my brothers and sisters are doctors. I kind of joke with people when we have family get-togethers that when you think about the material I'm dealing with, I'm kind of like a proctologist, so... Yeah, I've been giving a lot of speeches. I was giving a speech, and after the speech, usually people come around and talk to me, and there's this line that had formed, and this very strange man got in the line, and I saw him sort of work his way up into the line, and he cut in line, and when he came up to greet me, he said, "That speech was the worst speech I ever heard," and just took off. And I'm an editorial cartoonist. I have pretty thick skin. So it wasn't that bad of a shock. But then I watched this very odd man work his way along the side of the ballroom and then across the back of the ballroom. And he slowly made his way back up to the front, and he cut back in line. And so this time I was going to confront him. And as he got up to me, before I could say anything, he said, "That speech sucked," and he just took off. And so now my feelings were getting a little hurt. And so I watched this very strange man make his way along the side of the ballroom and across the back again. And then again, he cut his way up to the front of the line. And as he worked his way up to the front, this time I was going to grab him. But before I could grab him, he said, "Worst speech I ever heard," and took off. And again, he made his way back to the back of the room and back up to the front. And so I got hold of him, and he said, "Speech sucked, speech sucked." And then he worked away, and he ran off. And so my feelings were hurt, and I turned to the next person in line, and I said, "Who is that man, and what is the deal with him?" And she said, "Don't worry, that's Tom. He's kind of the village weirdo. Don't pay any heed to what he says, because he's kind of crazy, and he just repeats what everybody else says." A story with a twist, an element of humor to capture your attention, and then the fatal blow. In essence, that's editorial cartooning. When people ask me what is an editorial cartoonist, I always say, well, we're kind of a hybrid. We're a cross between Edward R. Murrow, Ted Koppel, and the Son of Sam. What I want to emphasize today is editorial cartoons are about concept. The illustration is merely a vehicle to convey a point of view. We're here to protect and inform the people. We're here to attack and repel those who do not share our long-term philosophical interests, to attract and compel the readers to arms in the battle against the complacent, the lethargic, the evildoers, the champions of the status quo, and the assorted predators of society. Now, basically, you could say I get paid to be obnoxious. Now, it's the only other profession besides dentistry where they get paid to be obnoxious. Now, politicians would have you believe that they're paid to be obnoxious. They're not paid to be. They're just obnoxious. It's a profession about ideas. 95% of what I do is concept or pushing a particular point of view. We are the pit bulls of journalism, and we're trained to attack at the slightest provocation. We are the prosecution pushing for a rapid conviction and an immediate execution. We are the defense punching holes in the arguments raised against our cause. We are judge. We are jury. I am not the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We stand in judgment over the issues, and the sentence that we levy is swift and harsh. But in order to be judge and jury, clearly one must read and research. So I have to confess, I have the most boring job in the world. What I do is I wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I read the three newspapers I read every day. I read IBD, Investors Business Daily, which is the best newspaper in the world. You can read it at ibdeditorials.com. Thank you. That's my editor over there. But I read that online before the day before. I read the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. I figure the truth lies somewhere between those editorial pages. I'm basically a political analyst. I'm a political wonk. And I read everything I can get my hands on, from the Weekly Standard to the National Review on the right side to The Nation and Mother Jones. I believe it's important to understand all sides of an issue, and I think that entails knowing the contrary point of view. I'm a firm believer in the statement, "Know thine enemy." So I spend my time gathering information. I process the information to draw a conclusion, to draw a cartoon, and hopefully to draw blood. Now, a reporter's job is to be the purveyor of fact, to point out the injustices of the world, and to shine the hot spotlight of exposure to wound the perpetrators of those injustices with the truth. Editorial cartoonists, we go back and shoot the wounded. Now, I want to make a distinction here between objective news reporting and the subjective editorial page. And I always find it funny when people call me up and they say, they call me other things besides Mr. Ramirez, but since we're in a mixed audience, I'll just say Mr. Ramirez. They say, "Mr. Ramirez, you're way too opinionated," to which I have to respond, "Well, that's why I'm on the opinion page." Now, I realize these days it's hard to distinguish between the two. The bias in the mainstream media is pretty apparent. I think in this last election cycle, they did a horrible job of vetting the candidates, and I think with this this new scandal with Blagojevich, and you look at Cook County. where the Chicago media actually did a pretty good job of vetting the candidates, but the mainstream national media ignored it completely. I think that's terrible. I think newspapers and the media have an obligation to give the readers the truth. And I want to sort of explore a few mythologies and debunk them. First, on the issue of weapons of mass destruction, let's just cut it out that there weren't any. There were weapons of mass destruction. If you went to the United Nations' own site, the UNSCUM site, you'll find a chronology of them finding weapons of mass destruction for the 10-year period that they were incorporated, and their weapons of biological, chemical, and nuclear basis. And this economy, when we talk about this economy and compare it to the Great Depression, well, there are a few comparisons, but let me shine some spotlight on that. During the Great Depression, you had a 25.7% unemployment rate. You had a negative 13.6% GDP growth. Now, obviously, we're doing much, much better than that. The parallels can be drawn in the plans that are used to remedy these problems, which during the campaign, hopefully it's changed now, but during the campaign, Obama had cited that he wanted to raise taxes on the wealthy and on individuals and on small businesses over $250,000. He wanted to impede free trade, regulate business, the overregulation of business. These are the things that you can draw parallels to in the late 20s and the early 30s, with the 1932 Revenue Act and Smoot-Hawley and the remedies to those. So clearly, I think newspapers and the media have an obligation to give the readers the truth. Not a filtered version of the truth, not a politically correct version of the truth, but simply the truth. Now, we're all human beings, and most journalists are as well, and they will undoubtedly have their own interpretation of events. But that's what makes it so important to cover an issue in its entirety, because differing perceptions can easily color an issue. Let me give you an example. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson were out camping one day, and as they lay down to sleep, Holmes turned to Watson and he said, "Watson, look up into the sky and tell me what you see." And Watson thought about it for a minute and he replied, "Well, I see millions and millions of stars." And Holmes said, "Well, what does that tell you?" And Watson replied, "Well, astronomically, it tells me that there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Theologically, it tells me, well, there must be a God to create something so magnificent. That God is great, and we are small and insignificant in comparison. Meteorologically, it tells me, well, it's a clear, beautiful sky tonight. It's probably going to be a clear, beautiful day tomorrow." And then Watson turned to Holmes, and he said, "Well, what does it tell you?" And Holmes looked up, and he said, "Somebody stole our tent." Two different views on the same event. So when I see newspapers and the networks being advocates rather than being purveyors of unbiased, objective news, when I see them in a libelous and slanderous pursuit against those simply because they don't agree with them philosophically, I get mad. That's my job. My job isn't a Republican thing. It's not a Democrat thing. It's not even about interpreting events through some broad philosophical filter. It's simply about delineating between right and wrong. Believe me, I view myself as an equal opportunity offender. And if I were to claim a party bias in my cartoons, I'd have to say I'm a member of the anti-stupid party. And my job is an exercise of common sense. Now, you cannot draw a cartoon that you do not believe in or cannot substantiate. And you must be confident enough in your opinion, confident enough in your research, to exclaim to the entire world, "There are two sides to every issue, my side and the wrong side." But clarity is the most important element of a cartoon. Because when you think about it, editorial cartoons are like advertising. With advertising, you make concise images to sell a product. With editorial cartoons, you're making concise images to sell an idea. But it has to be clear. I remember I did this cartoon once, and the issue was whether or not the FAA should impose drug testing on pilots. And so I drew this pilot dressed as Hamlet, and he was holding a beaker, and he was pondering, to pee or not to pee? That is the question. Well, I was inundated with cards and letters, mostly from pilots, and their chief complaint was pilots have four stripes, not three. So. And We were just talking about how crazy the political environment was and how true stories are sometimes funnier than things I can think of. It reminded me of this story the Secret Service agent told me when Bill Clinton was president, and the president brought his dog into the White House for the very first time, and the Secret Service agent asked him, "New dog, sir?" To which the president replied, "Yes, I got him for Hillary," to which the Secret Service agent replied, "Well, good trade, sir." I think that particular agent was reassigned to counting chads right down here. There are three types of editorial cartoonists today. There are those who merely illustrate current events. There are those who try to make humorous anecdotes about current events. And then there are those who try to make poignant statements with their cartoons to engage the reader in debate. Now, obviously, a good editorial cartoon will compose of all three elements. But the emphasis should be on the latter part, making poignant statements. That's why we're on the editorial page and not the comic page. Now, humor is a very, very powerful weapon. It facilitates the ability to reach a much, much larger audience with your message. But it is a message that defines it. It is a message that makes it an editorial cartoon. My friend Steve Kelly, who's the cartoonist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, had a great analogy for what a good, effective editorial cartoon would be. It's like going up to the unresponsive, unrepresentative politician and kneeing him in the groin as hard as you can. You can't guarantee that you'll change his tune, but you can guarantee he'll be singing a few octaves higher. And his wailing will be noticed by all, illuminating his performance. That's the bottom line. We want to illuminate their performance. We want to ensure that the politicians know that we're watching. Being nationally syndicated, one's compelled to be creative to compete in the market. And I think the cartoons with the unexpected punchlines are the ones that sell. Let me illustrate this with another story about Colonel Sanders and the Pope. And if I haven't offended you yet, just wait. Am I working a way around to it? Colonel Sanders approached the Pope shortly before he died, and he said, "Your Holiness, I'd like to leave my entire estate to the Holy Roman Catholic Church," to which the Pope replied, "Well, your soul will be saved, my son." And he said, "Well, you know, there's only one thing I want to ask for in return. You know that communion thing you guys have? Give us this day our daily bread. I was wondering if you could, you know, tweak it maybe a little bit and change it to give us this day our daily chicken." The Pope said, "Well, I'm sorry, that's a traditional rite with great symbolic significance. I'm afraid we can't change that." To which Colonel Sanders replied, "Well, that's unfortunate because my estate's worth $1.5 billion. Well, needless to say, the Pope convened a meeting with his economic advisors later in the day. And he announced the news. He said, "I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. The good news is the Holy Roman Catholic Church has just inherited $1.5 billion. The bad news is, well, we lost a Wonder Bread account." We live in a political system that's relegated to being merely reactive rather than being proactive. The editorial cartoonist takes on the role as the catalyst, the instigator, the protagonist, and the antagonist, luring the reader into the political process. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that I'm going to change people's minds. Hopefully that's going to happen. But what I'm trying to do is to inform the public, to make them aware, to take an issue to such an extreme that they will react, that they will get involved. We have a participatory democratic republic, the best system of governance in the world, truly a government of the people and by the people and for the people, but only if the people participate. Let me share another story. There's this duck, and he walked into the store, and he went up to the manager and said, "Got any grapes?" The manager looked at the duck and he said, "No, I have no grapes." Duck goes, "Oh," walks out. 10 minutes later, this duck comes waddling in, goes up to the manager and says, "Got any grapes?" Manager looks at him and says, "No, I don't have grapes." Duck goes, "Oh," walks out. 10 minutes later, this duck comes waddling in, goes up to the manager and says, "Got any grapes?" The manager says, "What's wrong with you, duck?" "I have no fruit section. I will never have grapes." Duck goes, "Oh," walks out. 10 minutes later, the duck comes waddling in, goes up to the manager, says, "Got any grapes?" Manager goes, "Look, I don't like grapes. I don't have grapes. I don't like ducks. Get out of my store." Duck goes, "Oh," walks out. 10 minutes later, the duck comes waddling in. The manager says, "Hold it right there, duck. If you ask me for grapes one more time, I'm going to nail your little web feet to the floor. Ask me for anything else. Don't ask me for grapes." The duck looks at him and says, "Got any nails?" He says, "No." "Got any grapes?" You see, this joke provides a good working analogy of how I view Washington bureaucracies at work. Because you see, in Washington, D.C., things are not always represented as they truly are. For example, a 6.5% increase in Medicare payments is not called a rational effort to save Medicare. It's called a draconian cut. A balanced budget amendment, which stipulates that Congress can only spend the amount of revenue they take in. It's not called common sense. It's called extremism, making illegal immigration illegal, a distinction from legal immigration. It's not called following the law. It's called insensitivity, judging someone not by the content of their character, but strictly by the color of their skin. It's not called racism. It's called affirmative action. Aborting a human fetus in its third trimester is not called killing. It's called a choice. And a surplus doesn't mean that we've paid too much in taxes. It means we've spent too little in services. And a tax is no longer a tax. It's called an investment in America. No, it's called patriotism. Well, I don't know about you, but I believe in the old adage, if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, then it's usually a duck. My job as an editorial cartoonist is to nail that duck to the floor. Because someone needs to watch over the institution for the intellectually challenged, excuse me, Congress, on behalf of the American public. Because of the pomp and circumstance that surrounds these career political celebrities, we're lulled into thinking it is we who work for them. It's the opposite. The politicians work for you, the constituents. You are their bosses. And that's why self-governance is so very, very important. Here's an interesting statistic. According to the 1990 census, there are 17.7 million people that manufacture goods in this country. According to the 1990 census, there are 18.8 million governmental workers in this country. There are more people that produce nothing but red tape than people that actually manufacture goods. I find that to be an alarming statistic. According to USA Today, state and local spending had increased by 31% before this economic downturn. And I don't feel like my government services are getting better by 31%. So this is where you have to be active in self-governance and get involved. As an editorial cartoonist, I try to do my part. We take the issues, we push them to the extreme to draw the readers into the national debate, to put the wheels of democracy into motion. To do that, I do cartoons. So I'm going to show you a bunch, do a quick conclusion, and then take your Q&A. This is an overhead of President Bill Clinton looking over the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. If you read the AP copy, it says, President Clinton looks into binoculars which still have the lens caps on. You know, when I won the 94 Pulitzer, I got a wonderful letter from the president and President Clinton, and I sent all my Clinton cartoons back with him and with a note that said, thank you, I couldn't have done it without you. I did get audited the next year, so. This is my book. I'm a capitalist pig. Please buy it. Now, this is from the 94 Pulitzer Collection. Aren't they supposed to face you when they bow? About U.S. and Japan trade. Now, I'm going to skim through some of these because you're going to have to buy the book to get them all. On the liberalization of the Catholic Church, in light of the modernization of society, we'd like to renegotiate the Ten Commandments down to 4.5. Our moral fabric. So images that are very concise and easily read, those make the best editorial cartoons. Father, you can't say prayers during graduation ceremonies, but if you print them on condoms, we'd be happy to distribute them. What I wanted to do on Father's Day, meet my father. Here's a black man with a black child, a white man with a white child. The black man's thinking white, the white man's thinking black. The kids are going, look, another kid. Skip these here. New York Governor Elliot Spitzer at his news conference. In ancient times, people worshipped the stars out of ignorance. You You know, when I first started working at the LA Times, I'd get all kinds of invitations to the Oscar parties and stuff. After 6 months of cartooning, boy, didn't hear a peep from them. Who had callously glamorized drugs and tobacco just for profit? Hollywood. Son, your father and I decided not to let you watch television anymore because it promotes violence. Touch my remote and I'll kill you. Remember Michael Jackson holding the kid over the banister? This is what the kid was thinking. Michael Jackson's my father? Oh, please let go. Here's his sister, Janet. Today on Martha Stewart Living, I'll be demonstrating how to cook your own goose. Marlboro Country. Let's see. Because of the soaring cost of medical malpractice insurance, we don't actually have any doctors left. But rest assured, we have the best lawyers operating on you today. The don't ask, don't tell policy. Don't ask, don't ask, don't ask. The GOP and cheap, easy handguns. That's Arnold. Let's get through some of these here. Viva Bilingual Education. And here to share his personal success story through bilingual education is Miguel K. Here's Barry Bonds trying to fill Babe Ruth's shoes. Saving Social Security. I'm going to try to get to politics. Here's the Lincoln bedroom during the Clinton administration. Not this way they could charge by the minute. The stain. Sorry about that. I know you guys just had lunch, but I did not have factual relations with the American people. Here's what he's Clinton with a buddy, his dog at the vet. Buddy's thinking, like I'm the one who needs to be neutered. It's a Clinton memorial. So he had to draw that at the precise right angle because his pants are around his ankles. So we'll skip through these here. This is when Nancy Pelosi wanted her own plane. I tried to get her to endorse my book. She wouldn't. Now, Senator Larry Craig at the Minneapolis airport, how embarrassing it is when you have a toilet paper stuck to your feet and then an agent stuck to the toilet paper. Jimmy Carter. This is an anatomically correct drawing. John McCain, the parting of the GOP. All right, we'll skip through some of these here because of time, I'm sorry. Dennis Kucinich, of course I've seen a UFO. How do you think I got here? John McCain, I can reach across the aisle to Democrats, no Republicans. Here I have Obama. This is my favorite cartoon of the election cycle. Here I have Obama as Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, and he's thrown 92 buckets of water on Hillary Clinton, but she won't go away. remember Elian Gonzalez? Here's Elian here. Yes, Elian, someday all this will be yours. In Cuba. Is Russia reverting back to Soviet-style oppression? You're darn Putin.
Let's skip through some of these here. Here's mini-me, Hugo Chavez. Putin again, what's the matter? Never seen a dolphin before. There's the Intifada. Skip two of these here. This is a cartoon I did for September 11th. So cartoons sometimes just invoke feelings. This is the way I felt on that day. The coordination of the intelligence agencies of the United States. I got it. Frankly, I can't think of a bigger threat to America than the assault on our civil liberties. This is the rush to war, 12-year period. And then my favorite cartoon, this is Saddam Hussein at the psychic, and she's saying, run. I'm going to skip through these and get to the end here because I know we have a time issue here. This is my favorite cartoon from this year's Pulitzer-winning entry. Obama as the Moab Easter Island statue. I have no idea what it is, but I feel strangely attracted to it. In Eden, as a matter of fact, we just bought another SUV. This is Putin's eye. I looked the man in the eye and I was able to get a sense of his soul, which is what Bush said on Putin. He was wearing contacts, so that's why he didn't get it right. Whatever the cost may be, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, and we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender. Harry Reid, run away. This is on ethanol. Excuse me, I'm going to need that to run my car. This is the gray wall between product safety inspections and their factories in China. Hillary Clinton, I pledge no more personal attacks on my drug-addicted, possibly Muslim opponent. I'm going to skip through some of these here. This is the automatic teller machine and the alternative minimum tax. And I think this is my favorite of the entry. Because it's actually Sheryl Crow's words. Her manager's introducing it to a gentleman. Meet Sheryl Crow. She uses only one square of toilet paper per bathroom visit to fight global warming. And the guy's looking at her hand like, you want me to shake that hand? Let me just do a brief conclusion. On September 11th, a group of cowards attacked America. They tried to redefine what America is, but they died in vain. You see, America isn't a structure of concrete and steel. It's built of stronger material. America is an idea. It's an idea conceived in freedom, nurtured in liberty, and delivered with justice. And it lives in the hearts and minds of all Americans. It lives in the acts of courage displayed by firemen, policemen, heroes, Americans, racing up stairwells into danger, the Twin Towers, to save fellow Americans. It lives in the heroic acts of husbands, wives, friends, passengers of United Flight 93, Americans, putting themselves in peril to protect this great nation and fellow Americans. It lives in the heroic acts of our military, our intelligence services, men and women, heroes, Americans, who will put their lives in harm's way to preserve freedom and to save fellow Americans. There is a high price for freedom. The terrorists have said they would die for their cause. What they don't realize is that Americans too will die for their cause. The cause of liberty and justice will continue because America isn't just a towering edifice on our landscape. America is an idea. It is a cause. It's real. And it's in each and every American, and no amount of explosives will bring it down. In America, we've been challenged by the forces of evil. But it is not the nature of Americans to run from adversity. Yes, Americans will risk their lives for a great cause. for the principles of liberty and justice for all, and the freedom and the courage of our convictions, our nation will rise to the challenge. Because in America, you're only limited by the boundaries of your imagination, and America truly is a land where dreams come true. Our nation will rise to the challenge, because that is America. For that, my friends, that is the spirit of America. So God bless America, and God bless you all. Thank you for having me here.
That was great. We have a lot of questions, and we're going to get to them in just a second, but you've been presenting a book to us. We've got a couple to present to you.
Great.
This is about Naples. You aren't going to get to see as much of it as I'm sure you'd like while you're here.
And I'll be back.
Yeah, and Marco Island, and we appreciate it.
Terrific.
Michael, as you would expect, there are a fair number of questions about President-elect Obama.
Oh.
Okay? So we're going to rush through three or four of these.
It's my mail ticket.
Yeah. That's exactly, right. You've already answered the first question. If you were to do a cartoon of the arrested governor of Illinois, what would you draw?
Well, you know what? I've got ideas. Can you hear me?
Is it working?
No.
You know, I've got a few ideas on that right now, but what's coming to mind is that I'm going to use that musical Chicago as a template. I think because that musical is about convicts, I think it's appropriate in this case. So let me just leave it at that. I don't want to give the idea away. But
do you think President-elect Obama will be a good target for your business?
You know, honestly, as an American, I'm hoping he won't be. And this is not about personalities. It's about issues. And I'm hoping, as every American is, that he can bring this country together and he can resolve the remedies. As an editorial cartoonist, I know that won't happen, so he'll be a great target.
These are two questions that are related, and I think you've answered them. Do you think it's possible President-elect Obama was not involved in discussions with the governor about his remote? I don't know why they think you would know the answer to that.
Oh.
But
well, I do talk to him on a daily basis because I'm one of his 330 advisors. No, I'm just kidding. You know, the fact that Rahm Emanuel has been very, very quiet leads me to believe that there's probably a lot more there. And knowing the nature of Chicago politics, you know, it could make your imagination run wild. We'll have to see what happens.
On the other side of the aisle, mm-hmm. Any comments on Sarah Palin and her future and what you might draw about her?
Yeah. I saw a reindeer running down the street the other day with Sarah Palin chasing after it with a shotgun. I think she'll probably be a pretty good target. You know, at IBD, we actually interviewed her in April about energy issues, and she was very articulate and very eloquent. I think it'll be problematic for the GOP, though, if she is the leading light for the GOP. I think she probably needs to get up to speed on a broader range of subjects before she's what I think qualified for president, but that's just my opinion.
This is from a reader of yours. I have been a subscriber to IBD for years, but it is not a well-known newspaper. How did you get there?
It's ibdeditorials.com. Well, you see, I made a left at the 105 and took a right down PCH. You know what? Bill O'Neill, I've actually been an IBD fan for a long time, and when I left the LA Times, I got a few offers from papers. One of them was William O'Neill. He offered me the job as the editorial cartoonist, but I didn't want to work for another paper because my syndication's doing really well, and I didn't have to work in kind of the closed environment. You know, as you can tell at the LA Times, philosophically, we were very, very different. And it was kind of problematic having to put on the Kevlar vest every time I went into work. But Bill O'Neill, actually, we had lunch together, and after the lunch, he surprised me by offering me the editorial page editor position, which I thought was sort of like the Peter Principle, or as I like to call it, the Rubin Principle now. I knew I was not nearly qualified for that job, but they've given me great influence over the editorial page, so I'm sort of co-managing that editorial page, and I think IBD has the best editorial page in the country.
It is a wonderful paper, by the way. If you don't read it, you ought to occasionally just to become acquainted with it. Please comment on the suitability of Doonesbury and Millard Fillmore being on the comics page rather than the editorial page.
You know, that's been a long debate for many years, and I think it's fine on the comic page because, frankly, even though they do delve into politics on kind of a superficial level and sometimes very pointed, you know, they are comic strips, and I think they're good for either the comic page or the editorial page. But some of the best commentary that I've ever seen was actually in BC, that BC strip, because I think the best cartoon on sort of the budget cuts and stuff was and the exaggeration of the effects of budget cuts was one that I saw on the BC comic strip with the, you know, the cavemen and stuff, and the cave girl was walking up and she said, you know, I have a cut on my finger, and the next caveman said, oh, that's a horrendous cut, and the other one said, that's a terrible, terrible cut, and it just got worse and worse, and it was obviously a reference to what was going on in D.C. So I think it's good. I think people ought to be politically engaged. That's the nature of a democratic republic.
These are two related questions. One says, the ratings of the Congress are worse than even George Bush. How can we get them, Congress, to care about America? And the second question is, what is the most effective active participation that we as voters and taxpayers can do?
I mean, I did a cartoon on this last week when the new job numbers came out with the job losses. I was looking for a specific area, you know, 535 jobs lost in the D.C. area. I have to say, this congressional leadership has been horrible. Probably the most unintelligent, non-job-oriented or goal-oriented Congress that I've seen in a long, long time. And they seem to be wrestling more with politics than getting things done. As a taxpayer and with a wallet in my back pocket, I'm kind of glad that they're stifled as far as doing anything. But they have been horrible. And this is where it's the responsibility of every citizen to get engaged and to contact your representatives and tell them what a horrible job that they're doing. And their ratings are 10 points below the president's. Actually, the president's ratings have gone up. And it's because of the horrible, horrible job that they've done.
This is a very serious question for those of us who are in journalism. What are your thoughts on the Danish cartoons that caused so much trouble and even deaths and riots and so on?
I think that's a tragedy. I was telling one of the students earlier today, the wonderful thing about our country is it's our First Amendment right, and that's the right to be obnoxious. I don't do controversial cartoons for the sake of controversy. Just in the same respect that I don't do humorous cartoons for the sake of humor. And I don't want the controversy of the subject matter overpowering the message of the cartoon. So I have a tendency to shy away from that. But I believe that in this country you have a right to do that. And you know, I was down in Cuba, just a little short story. I was down in Cuba with PBS, and you know, I got a chance to interview the interior minister, and I was telling one of the gals this story earlier. And you know, I brought up the Brother in Arms flight that was shot down in international airspace. The interior minister refused to answer that question. The tugboat that was towed outside of Havana Harbor with 76 people, 26 children, that they capsized and hosed down. Questions about their journalists being arrested and political groups that have been arrested. And he wouldn't answer any of those questions. So I focused on the journalism in Grandma, their paper, and I said, you know, they have to go through several committees to get their stuff in print, and that the editorial cartoonists could not do cartoons on Che Guevara or Fidel Castro. And I said, look, let me ask you one last question. You know, in America, we believe that a country that can't make fun of its leaders is a country imprisoned by its leaders. So I asked you this one last question. They zoomed the camera in on his face, and I said, what's your favorite Fidel Castro joke? And his face went white, and little beads of sweat gathered on his forehead, and he couldn't answer it. And it's because they don't have freedom of information, freedom to demonstrate what they believe. And I think that's very, very important. I think the Danish cartoonists have every right to draw cartoons.
And finally, as a last question, we have people here who are very interested in education, and so maybe you can help them with their jobs. What did your parents do to raise such great children?
4 out of 5 isn't bad. You know what? I think the most important thing my parents instilled in me was a belief that you could achieve anything with the proper dedication and dedication of time to achieve it. And they always told us that there is nothing beyond our goal. So I would say to the educators and to the kids that the only restraint you have is yourself. And if you absolutely firmly believe in something, in a goal, and if you dedicate yourself completely to it, America is an environment where you can get it accomplished. And so I looked at you guys as you stood up here, and I'm looking for your faces on Time magazine in the next 2 decades. I wish you all the success.
Thank you very much. We'll see you on January 9.
Great. Sorry, I went a little over. But
No, it was perfect. Yeah. It was perfect. Thank you. Just cut the question shorter. Everybody would have loved to have seen...